Session number 10420, rule 45.
Colonel W.I. Watson, Reel 45. You were reading out your list of booty from the battlefield, Colonel.
Yes, yes. And my little share of such booty was a bottle of eau de cologne for the bath brought to me by my worthy driver, Parkinson. And that night I did in fact have a bath, so-called bath, in my little canvas bath. And I put some of this stuff in the water, and my tent smelt like Flourish's shop in Jermyn Street in London. And there was a Lance Corporal I had in the battalion headquarters called Lance Corporal Common, and he acquired some cigarettes. And really, what they were constructed of or made of, I really don't know, but it was quite impossible to walk into the battalion headquarters while Corporal Common was smoking one of his cigarettes. Now, after the battle was over, I wrote to my mother, and she kept all my letters. And this is what I wrote to her in the letter immediately after we'd finished the battle. The British soldier is a wonderful character. He enjoyed every moment of the day collecting the swag, yet he was dead tired and had not had any or little sleep for two nights. The hero who brought in the old bicycle of parachute pattern thought he was doing noble work and could not see any joke in his pal's remark when wheeling the thing across the rough part of southern Tunisia. Got a telegram for us, Geordie. The North countryman fights like a tiger, and yet he can never see the line of reasoning that once you knock a man down, so to speak, he wants holding down and well finishing off so as not to get up again and start making a nuisance of himself. That's not sporting in his view. For instance, any wounded Italian or German who came in was helped, given food, and helped to eat it if his arm was wounded, given water and cigarettes. Yet for the last few days, the latter commodity have been exceedingly scarce. And so the day wore on, and gradually the battle passed on, or rather the chase. Finally, about 10 p.m., the last lone German prisoner walked in, a youth aged 18, who'd been out here since 1942, nerve-wracked, shattered, and completely demoralized. And so ended our part in the Battle of the Wadi Akarit. Well, the next day we were moved back to our former divisional concentration area some 5 miles behind where we then were. Here, as a farewell gesture to General Crasher, we held a parade in column of companies for his inspection. We did a rehearsal the day before, and every man had his hair cut, and every uniform, including my own, was starched with rice water and spaghetti water captured from the Italians. And it was ironed by using the irons which the quartermaster, and which also I had in my old company, and it was ironed absolutely meticulously. And the equipment was all scrubbed with natural blanco, because the rocks, soft rocks, were a form of blanco, and white, of course, all our equipment in the desert was white. And every man's water bottle cork had a string attached to it to the water bottle. Many of them had disappeared in the course of the action, but they were all replaced before this parade. And when the general came onto the parade ground, I gave the general salute, present arms, and the buglers, three buglers, which we still had in the battalion, using three bugles, which the quartermaster kept in his drawer, blew the general salute. Afterwards, the general marched round and inspected the whole battalion, as I say, drawn up in column of companies. Every man's shirt sleeves were turned up to the prescribed width of a cigarette packet. And you know, I'm sure he was deeply affected. Not only was he pleased to see it, but he was really affected by that a whole battalion should be there to give him the general salute, which he probably never had. He came to me afterwards, after he'd inspected the battalion and after he left it. He said it was the best battalion he'd ever seen in the Western Desert, and it always went into action as well turned out as it was on parade that day. And it's rather interesting, if I can interrupt there. When we returned weeks later to Cabrit to do our combined op training, Andrew Clark and I met Crasher Nichols, and he told us why he had been got rid of. He gave us his version. He was too young. He was too young to have been promoted in the first instance. And we had a long, he and Andrew Clark and I had a long talk with him. He was out of work at the time, and he was spending his days in Alexandria. Now, I want to jump even still further, just for a moment, to after the war, when I was married and Barnard Castle was a garrison town. My wife and I were invited to a parade, some ceremonial parade, given by the Border Regiment in Deerbolt Camp. Now, the Border Regiment was Crasher's regiment. And she and I climbed up onto one of the stands to view the parade. And there, all alone in a dirty, rather tatty leather coat, sat Crasher Nichols. He always considered himself a bit of a lad with the girls, but he wasn't that day. He was completely alone. And I went up to him and said, "Now look here, if ever you come to see your regiment again, you must come and stay with me and my wife." And he did. He actually stayed here where we are now. And but he was getting near the end of his life. His signature in the visitor's book is very, very shaky indeed. And he subsequently died very shortly afterwards.
Did you ever learn of the official reason why he was moved?
Yes. Now, that's what I'm coming to. After this happened, my wife and I offered hospitality to the Prince of Wales' volunteer regiment, the South Lancashire regiment, which were going to be presented with colours in the Bowdoin Museum Park, just across where we are on the other side of the road from where we are now, by Monty. And we thought we would put up the mayor of Preston or something like that. But no, we had to put up the colonel of the regiment. And we were asked if the distinguished guests could come and assemble here before walking across the road into the museum park, and in particular, Monty himself. And could he put on his medals and get himself titivated up before going to carry out the presentation? We said yes, and I've found or provided for him two batmen, two servants from the 1st Battalion, which was then in one of the camps here. And as I walked up the stairs here, just outside from where we're sitting with Monty, to show him the bedroom in which he could put his medals on and that sort of thing, he said to me, "Oh, Watson, who was your divisional commander in the Western Desert?" And I said, "Oh, you know, sir, Crasher Nichols." And Monty replied, "Ah, yes, Crasher. We thought he'd reached his ceiling, so we had to get rid of him." And I then said to Monty, "You know, sir, he's now dead." And Monty replied, "Crasher dead? Did he die of drink?" So, in really speaking, I heard both sides of the story, from Crasher himself in Alexandria and from Monty walking up the stairs in the house here. Well, let's move on now. That was the end of Crasher so far as our general.
Who's your brigade commander at this time? You've changed the
brigade. The brigade commander at this time was Ronnie Senior, who's now dead, of course. Yes. And he had taken over as brigade commander. Crasher did tell us in Alexandria, as a matter of fact, that he hardly knew him. But that Beak, incidentally Beak, the previous brigadier, had been earmarked for departure before the Battle of Marath. Crasher told us that. And Beak went to be brigadier for a Greek brigade. Anyhow, the next day we received a warning order that we were to continue our move westwards, and it would be the 13th of April. We went to a staging area just about 6 miles west of Sfax, a journey of some 70 miles. The first part of the journey was truly dreadful, over a terrible track worn by the 7th Armoured Division moving up, and we encamped not far from Sfax. But then the second part of the journey was through really, truly delightful country. Acres and acres of green corn growing, with splashes of poppies growing in it, and miles and miles and miles of olive groves. And we camped where we stopped that night, in an olive grove. And I remember there that I heard the cuckoo. So I thought, really, we are getting back to civilization at last. And then the next day we moved on, and I sent my number two, second in command, Dominic Parker, he was acting then as second in command, into Sfax to see if he could get some fresh vegetables and wine for us, because Tunis is a wine growing country. He found Sfax badly damaged, but there was no wine for sale to the troops, because the Highland Division had misbehaved themselves in the Sfax, and they had stopped selling wine to any soldiers, and the vegetable market was closed. I remember that day too, passing a large French farm with the tricolour flying from the top, whitewashed Now, of course, it was olives all round it and the blue sky and green corn. And the farmer himself was immaculately turned out in perfect riding breeches and riding clothes, and he had a little daughter with him. And I wondered how on earth he'd survived all the fighting that had been carried out around him. And then on the 15th of April, the next day, we had a bad journey. It started well through the town of Karawan. Now, I believe Karawan is the next holy place almost after Mecca. There are lots of mosques there, and really to go there for a holiday would have been really delightful. What distressed our journey was really that made our journey so difficult was that the 4th Indian Division got mixed up with us terribly on the road, all jockeying for positions to get us forward as fast as possible. Incidentally, Karawan was full of fat Americans, French and English troops, to the delight of the French, because we'd now joined up with the First Army. We'd linked up with the First Army. But the whole day was blotted by the death of Corporal Edwards. Now, Corporal Edwards was an Argyll and Sutherland Highlander who was quite first class, and he commanded a carrier. And as we were going down over a dried wadi into Karawan, and then turning up the bank on the other side, I think the track of his carrier must have locked, and of course that means the carrier turns over. Poor chap, he was killed. But he was terribly popular in the battalion, and the battalion raised something like £200 and sent it to his widow. Put their hands in their pockets, and the cheque was sent to his widow. Well, that was through Karawan. Then on the 16th day, 16th of April, we moved onwards to a truly delightful sight on the high ground above the seashore outside the little whitewashed village of Herga. You've got to remember every day was cloudless and blue sky and everything so looked so lovely. After we'd been for days and months and weeks and in the desert. And beyond us, we could look down onto a plain, a flat plain, in the middle of which was the little town of Amfideville. Now, on the high ground, too, were the Scots Guards. They were investing, you might say, on Amfideville. And they were behind banks, in ditches and dikes, looking down over the town. And beyond the town, beyond the plain, was a ridge of hills coming down to the sea, not unlike the Romana feature at Wadi Akrit, but they were higher and covered in vines, the vineyards stretching right up the hillside. Typical French, a characteristic of the south of France. And it was there that I saw the superb sight against the blue sky of a flock of flamingos making their way across the Mediterranean to nest in the Camargue in the south of France. And when I went back on one of my later visits to the Battle of Marathon, I talked about this to a dear old colonel in the Tunisian army, a very old man indeed, who was also bird-minded. And he told me that flamingos did in fact nest in Tunisia in a certain place, but he said thought these would be working their way to the Camargue in south of France. When I went to my opposite number to check up with him, this commanding officer of the Scots Guards. I went into his little dugout place, and Parkinson remained outside, my driver. And one of the jocks said to Parkinson, who told me afterwards, "Good God, you bees here again, because this was the second or if not the third time we'd come to help the Scots Guards. Now, Monty's plan was to do a left hook with the 4th Indian Division and the New Zealand Division in the hope that the enemy would pull out of Honfleteville and would save any frontal attack, which we would have had to do. And for the first 3 nights we were there, we had to send patrols to try and get into Honfleteville to see, find out the lie of the land and what opposition there was there. However, this was extremely difficult because of the dogs. The inhabitants were still there, living in the town, and they were still with their dogs there. So we really never got into the village itself. Now, it struck me that we might be able to carry out a certain amount of irritation to the enemy, because there was, running along westwards as far as the eye could see, a spit or causeway between the sea and a very big mud flat. And then beyond the mud flat was the coast road running away back into Tunisia. And I thought it would be really rather a good thing if I could get my carriers to creep up this and then lob a few mortar bombs on the German positions to just show that we were trying to get round the right flank. It was not likely it would succeed very much, but nevertheless, it was worth trying. So on the 19th of April, Attenborough, who was commanding the carriers with the mortars, crept along this sort of catwalk on the sea side of it, so they were not in view of the enemy. And they moved out before dawn, and they were joined by the mortar officer Hampson, mortar officer of the 8th DLI, and they moved extremely quietly at 6 a.m. forward. The mist, sea mist, and hindered all operations till about 10 a.m., and then they did see three enemy positions clearly visible, with working parties laying mines, and our mortars dropped 20 bombs on them. The guns in the hills replied on the Scots Guards and the positions of the 8th DLI, but we pulled back, and having dropped these bombs on these working parties. Well, on the next day, I thought, well, we'll have another go at this little operation. And the Scots Guards and some of the 8th Armoured Brigade did in fact enter Honfleteville and find it empty. And so the last operation of Attenborough, and our last operation in the Western Desert, was that again the carriers and the mortars went out along the spit, but they were eventually stopped by a water drain that drained the mud fat into the sea and vice versa, and some enemy mines. They were bitterly disappointed that they could only watch the distant enemy vehicles retreating to Boo Fisher, and the gunner OP that was with them found it was too late because of the mist. And that was the last sight we had of the Germans in the Western Desert. They were retreating back to Boo Fisher, Tunis, and Cape Bon. That night, I went to a CO's conference with the Brigadier, and he announced that we were to return to Egypt. It was the bitterest disappointment to all our chaps. I mean, really was. They thought, this is really too awful for words. We've come these 2,000 miles, fought and scrapped the whole way, and now we're to turn round and go back. It was really the most appalling anticlimax that you could have imagined. We'd just seen our last sight of the Germans retreating up the coast road to their end, and Amphideville was empty. And anyhow, the next day we started the return journey, and we were told openly that we ceased to have an operational role. And that...
And he gave you no clues as to what you were going to go on for?
No. Not then. We were told that it was going to be some strange training, that we'd training which we'd not done before. And so we really came to the conclusion that probably it would be combined ops if we were going to go all the way back to Egypt. Well, on the 21st of April, we turned round and started our return journey. Now, that was the day Father took the 1st Battalion into the 2nd Battle of Reap, and we turned round and went back to Egypt, started the long journey back to Egypt. We passed Sousse on the way back, and we had to hand in our carriers